sins, seven ways to win, seven holy paths to hell, and your trip begins. Seven downward slopes, seven bloodied hopes, seven are your burning fires, seven your desires.
Seventh son of a seventh son. First of all, let me ask you, why that title?
Well, it's a concept album, believe it or not. Yeah, sounds a bit ominous, doesn't it? But, well, originally I had the idea for a song called The Clairvoyant when Doris Stokes died. Just thought, well, it's a bit strange, you know, if she was a clairvoyant, I wonder if she could foresee her own death, you know? That sort of sparked me off with the song Clairvoyant. And then I was the idea for a song of Seventh Son of a Seventh Son, which all ties in with, you know, because it's supposed to have the powers of clairvoyance and healing and sixth sense, whatever, you know. And so when I actually spoke with Bruce about the basic idea, he went overboard about it, thought it was a great idea and everything, and so we decided to write all the lyrics based around that.
Myself and Steve, we decided that this was going to be what the lyrics were going to be about. No matter what direction music went, we wanted the whole thing to fit together lyrically. And so when I wrote, I took whatever lyrics I had and looked at them from that angle and thought, well, how can we fit them in? And we came to the situation where Moonchild was basically the devil trying to claim this kid for his own and foretelling all the temptations and all the nasty things he was going to put in his path, because this kid is born with free will. Good and evil both trying to claim him, but really this kid has free will, and he's also innocent. He knows nothing whatsoever of all this stuff that's going to happen to him. Infinite Dreams, the next track, is basically, that's what it's about, Infinite Dreams, these terrible dreams he has in which he sees infinity, and he can't deal with that situation either, but he's not yet aware of what it means, of its significance. Can I Play With Madness is when he goes to a fortune teller or soothsayer or crystal ball gazer, whatever, and he asks the question, can I play with madness, because that's what he thinks is in his head.
I think that the good thing about it is it's a natural song. It's not like, because originally the song we had, you know, that we thought, oh, this is going to be the single, was Evil That Men Do. And then Can I Play With Madness came along, and it wasn't like we actually planned to have, you know, a big sort of, you know, single or whatever, but as soon as that came along, we thought, oh, well, that's got to be the first single.
It came about out of a pure happening. It was a song that was written, and Bruce had an idea, and Steve came up with the middle section, and we put it together, we worked it out, and we didn't really believe it was going to work, and it did. And because of that, it's got the magic about it, what it has. And so I think it's going to be a very good, successful single. You know? It is below 4 minutes long as well, so the radio companies are going to go, hey, these guys are going to...
What is this reference, aside from it being your seventh album?
Actually, if you kind of have a look throughout the album, you find Edward, actually...
This is Edward the Seventh. And here is England.
There's the apple.
This is Concord as a stork eating a flying fish here as well, which means something. I'm not quite sure what.
So what does your album sound like? How's it different from the last one?
It's a concept album. At last, we've done one. We actually, all our career, people are saying, go on, it's a concept album, isn't it? We said, no, it isn't, really. It's just, you know, it's not. Well, this one really is, and it deals with the life and times of a seventh son of a seventh son, which I don't know if you know anything about the biblical bit and the folklore bit and everything, but a seventh son of a seventh son was supposedly a person of great significance. He supposedly had either clairvoyant or healing or some kind of magical powers or whatever. Anyway, this kid's born who doesn't ask to have any of this, but he has to deal with it throughout his life. And the album deals with the life and times of him and his journey through life and what other people think of him and how he deals with it and how he deals with himself and all that kind of stuff, because he's very different. But also there's the tales from the dark side coming up, of course, from the crypt. See, there's also, you get the idea that God and the devil are both just like playing games with him, you know, that maybe he's just some kind of pawn in some game they're playing.
We'll be right back. Hello, welcome to Rock and or Roll. I'm your reluctant host, BJ, and I'm pleased to be joined once again by Craig Smith from the Pods and Sods Network. Hey, Craig.
Hey, BJ, how you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
Doing well. Thank you for having me on in this series.
Episode number 7 in the Iron Maiden series, and so guess which album was number 7 for Iron Maiden?
Appropriately titled.
Yeah. So I know I've heard you say, what do you say, that you were the kid with a Maiden patch and Duran Duran buttons on the same jean jacket or something like that?
Yeah, I would have been wearing a Duran Duran shirt. I would have had maybe like Iron Maiden pins. I remember, you know, back in the days, obviously, you know, I'm 43, so we're looking at, you know, my late elementary school years. Before you found all the singles and all that kind of stuff, we would find, me and my friend Ryan, we would go to the mall and find Eddie artwork on buttons. And we didn't know that, like, this is the Purgatory cover and this is the Run of the Hills cover. It was just like all, I must have had maybe like 20 or 25 of these things on my jacket. So yeah, Duran Duran shirt, Iron Maiden jacket, probably a Kiss patch on the back of the jacket, and just a complete fucking outcast. Just ridiculous.
Yeah, but so the Maiden fandom goes way back for you, like to elementary school?
Yeah, it goes way back, but it doesn't last very long. I've always appreciated them, but the time period for me, I got into them probably right around Peace of Mind. My little chunk of Maiden fandom really goes from Number of the Beast to Live After Death, and that was what I really devoured as a kid. And I've, you know, gone back here and there, and of course I've gotten all the DVDs, all the live shows, and I own everything, but that's really the chunk I go back to. So I was not overly familiar with this record as a whole. I, of course, knew various tracks from it, but yeah, I was glad that you asked me to do this because it forced me out of the pocket of Maiden that's comfortable for me. And there are various bands like that where I know that I should really just dig deeper into the catalog, but you're, you know, stuck in that little, I'm that way with Rush too. I'm stuck in that little pocket of Rush, and I know that there's probably great things if I go outside of that. I just haven't done it yet, you know?
I remember I could tell when we were talking about which album to do that you were like, yeah, put me now for Seventh Son, because you wanted to kind of get into one that you haven't really gone that deep into before.
We had done an episode, one of our Kisscovery episodes, and it was mentioned and it was praised. And so it was on my short list of things that I should check out soon. So I was very glad that this one was open. So I feel kind of honored.
Yeah, this is like not an album that anybody was, you know, clamoring to do. Everybody was fighting over Peace of Mind and, you know, Number of the Beast and everything, so.
Yeah, I guess that makes sense. Like, we did episodes on Peace of Mind and Power Slave, but, like, everything I read about this said that it was highly regarded in the catalog. So I've just kind of had, I mean, at least during this time that I've been listening to it, I've kind of had this idea that, like, this album was coveted. Is that not the case? I mean, you know more about this thing as a whole than I do.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like that's the case. I know for me, my personal opinion, this is probably my third favorite song for song. This is probably like my third favorite Maiden album. I think I love it.
After what?
After Killers and then Peace of Mind and then probably
Killers,
this.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Just based on my personal opinion and just, you know, the quality, like the consistency of the songs, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, you know, there's definitely albums where, you know, you've got a song like Run to the Hills on Number of the Beast. If the whole album was that, if all the songs were that good, you know, then that would be the best. But it's just, as far as the number of songs that I really love, I would say Seventh Son is right up there.
Okay.
Going back to liking Iron Maiden in the 80s as a kid, I mean, I think you had to be there to even understand what it was to be a teenager in the 80s. Who liked Iron Maiden. It was such a different, you know, dynamic that someone who wasn't there couldn't even understand anymore.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Like I think I was probably 12 when Live After Death came out. And I remember my friend owning it. I had it on cassette. My friend had it on vinyl. So he had the book and all that. And I was just like, Jesus Christ, like, look at all this stuff in here. And that, like I said, that's kind of where it ends for me. So I wouldn't even say teenager for me. Like, you know, I think that Iron Maiden, and people are going to tune out as soon as I say this, but I think Iron Maiden were pushed aside for me by hip hop at the time. And then, you know, that was pretty much what I was into following, you know, this portion of, and I still went back, and it wasn't like I dropped it completely, but like, that was really my focus for a while until, you know, Run DMC brought Aerosmith, gave them a career again, ruined that for me. So yeah, like I was really past the Iron Maiden thing by the time I was 12. But like, you know, like I said, I dip back now and then, and, you know, still have always enjoyed it. Never kind of really let the albums go that I loved so much, but just, you know, never went in deeper. But it's, you know, I have great memories of, like, you know, my friend would get, like, I'll never forget, he got the Trooper single and took it to the you know, the local library and photocopied the cover and gave me like a 5-cent Xerox of the cover. If you like scratched it with your fingernail, the ink would come off, and it was like coveted, you know, because I, you know, couldn't buy all these singles and all this, and was just like mesmerized by the artwork, and like all of it was a monumental thing for me at that age. Like, it really, you know, really came together in terms of the visuals and the music, and was something that I just really, really loved.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I, you know, in preparation for doing this, I pulled out the sleeve, the Seventh Son of a Seventh Son inner sleeve, and it just took me back. I don't know when's the last time I even looked at that.
You have it on vinyl.
Yeah. And, you know, pulling it out, the lyrics, the picture that's on there, it just, you know, it took me back to that time, you know, when I was a kid, and you would just, you would listen to it and you would stare at that. You know, it's sad now at this age, music is usually in the background when I'm doing something else too much of the time. And, you know, but back then you used to just, you just were focusing on listening, and you'd be holding that sleeve, and that's all you were doing.
Yeah. And I remember there was a great book that I got when I was a kid. It might have been called Running Free. And it had all of the artwork in it for everything, like the Christmas cards that they sent out through the fan club and all that stuff. So, and I think it went up to Power Slave, but it was just so great. I love just looking at all that stuff.
Everybody talking about the seventh son in the whole round world. There is only one, and I'm the one. I'm the one. I'm the one. I'm the one. The one to call the seventh son.
So the seventh son of a seventh son, I guess this is an old concept from folklore, where the seventh son of a seventh son, and that's an unbroken line, so there can't be any daughters. You know, it's got to be seven straight boys in two successive generations or whatever. And that person, which, I mean, that's got to be incredibly rare. And yeah, that person would be imbued with special powers, you know, see the future, heal sick people, that kind of stuff. I don't really know how far back that concept goes, but I guess Steve Harris was exposed to the idea by that Orson Scott Card science fiction novel, Seventh Son, which, beyond just the idea of a seventh son of a seventh son, I don't really see much connection between the book and the album.
Right.
Just beyond the very basic concept.
Right. But it's very loose.
Yeah. But that is what Steve Harris credits, is that novel. Apparently that guy Orson Scott Card is like a homophobic douchebag. I saw Googling him. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I was not aware. I didn't dive that far in. I'm glad that you did.
Yeah. I went and got the book at Half Price Books, and I think I read maybe 10 pages and said, nah. And it was just about, like, some young girl on a farm or something. It was like I was reading Charlotte's Web. I don't know where it was going, but...
You're like, where's the harmonized guitars?
Yeah.
What chapter do they kick in?
But then I read the plot summary on Wikipedia, and I don't see where hardly any of it... There's none of it in the lyrics on this album, really.
Okay.
So... All right. Well, but it did, you know, obviously the concept fit perfectly because this was going to be the band's seventh studio album. Right. So that was, I guess that was really what he latched onto, is Seventh Son of a Seventh Son as the seventh album. And as the story goes, Steve Harris called up Bruce Dickinson and told him he had this idea to make it like a concept album. And Bruce Dickinson was really excited to get that call because he was completely left out of the creative process on Somewhere in Time.
What do you think of that album? I mean, I don't want to, I guess I could wait until the episode goes up, but like just in general.
There's some really great songs, but probably about half of it is just kind of so-so.
Okay.
Yeah. It's not one of my favorites.
Yeah. I do love Wasted Years.
Yeah, Wasted Years is great.
A great, great single.
Yeah. Probably Steve Harris reaching out to Bruce Dickinson in the early stages.
Reaching
of
this. I see what you did there. That title.
Yeah.
Which is also a great song.
Yeah, that is a great song. I think that's the Reach that out. Was the To Play Us Out song on the last episode, actually.
Oh, nice.
But I have to think Steve Harris, it was kind of you know, he probably knew that he had to really involve Bruce in the creative process on the next album because they had a difficult time there.
Yeah.
So he reached out to him right at the very beginning and got Bruce involved, and Bruce got excited about it. But then, you know, this idea, like Steve Harris said, it was going to be a full-fledged concept album. That was his quote. But, you know, the end product certainly isn't
full-fledged. No, not in the dictionary sense.
Yeah. And Bruce Dickinson, what he had to say about it years later, he said, it's half a concept album is what he said. And his quote was, there was no attempt to see it all the way through like we really should have done. It has no story. It's about good and evil.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's the problem with a lot of these albums that bands will call a concept album. They don't have a coherent story. And
yeah, you can't really just throw, you know, a bunch of songs that kind of vaguely, you know, tread the same sort of ground and call it a concept album if there's no through line.
Right. And you know, it's happened too often where people would just say, yeah, it's a concept album just because there's maybe a theme. But, you know, a theme doesn't make... I mean, I guess there could be a debate over what is a concept album, but to me, a concept album should have a story that is told over the course of the songs.
Right, like Sgt. Pepper does.
Yeah, sort of.
Sarcasm.
I mean, to me, the best concept album, especially in terms of story, is Operation Mindcrime.
Because
you get character arcs and you get a plot that you can at least follow, you know?
I was going to go with Tommy, but that's a good one.
Yeah. I mean, well, they call Tommy an opera, right? But yeah, I mean,
yeah,
well,
that's true.
Or Quadrophenia. Yeah,
Quadrophenia is great, too.
Yeah. Or even like The Wall, you end up getting a lot of really surreal. There's a surreal element where you have to put it together yourself.
Yeah. But it makes sense.
Yeah, it does make sense. But I really enjoy the story of Operation Mindcrime. And I hear elements of Operation Mindcrime in Seventh Son. Like, I think there are some similarities.
Oh, interesting.
But, and also there are some similarities with The Elder too, with Seventh Son.
Really?
Yeah, don't you think? Just like with the story, just like the vague story, fill in the blanks.
Yeah, in that respect, yes. They should have left the spoken bits between songs in.
Do you think it's a concept album? Like, what do you, or do you think?
Not, you know, not that I could really grasp onto.
Yeah,
you know, pretty much just what you said. Like, it kind of flirts with similar themes, but there's, like you said, there is no kind of arc as there would be on like an Operation Mindcrime. So, and again, you'd really need a definition of concept album, but in my view, no.
Yeah, because the sequence of songs just, they don't tell a story. There's
like... and also, the songs don't segue together.
Yeah,
I need that in a concept album. It's a stupid thing, but I need songs to segue together.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that is a cool element if it's done right.
Yeah, totally.
So I guess overarching themes, mm-hmm. that's what the album has, but... to me, that doesn't make it a concept album.
Yeah, I think we're in the same boat there.
So then it kind of gets annoying when they, when they call it a concept album. Because
yeah, I just didn't even look at it as such, really.
I tried to figure out, you know, if they're gonna say it's a concept album, where's the concept? And yeah, it's mm-hmm. there's it's just not there.
Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, I played some clips at the beginning of this episode of Bruce Dickinson trying to justify the idea, so it's kind of fun to listen to where he
that's awesome.
Tries to go through the story of the songs. But yeah, so the album came out April 11th, 1988, went straight to number one in England, and they had four top 10 hits in the UK off this record.
Yeah, that's crazy to me because when I, you know, would get the best ofs or the live stuff, like I didn't know this stuff at all.
Yeah.
So like when this came out, this was not on my radar. I didn't even buy Somewhere in Time, and I don't know why I didn't at the time, you know, other than it just not really being my flavor anymore. But I don't know. Maybe there might have been something about that cover that kind of turned me off, like to Somewhere in Time. Like this is a different sort of Iron Maiden here. It's not the Eddie artwork that we've gotten on, you know, the previous studio albums and then Live After Death. So when this came out, I might have just seen like the ad in Circus or Hit Parade, and that might have been like the extent of my exposure to it. So yeah, amazing that they were so huge, those songs, you know, overseas.
Yeah, from what I read, it was at the time, at least, it was their biggest selling album everywhere in the world except in the U.S.
That's crazy. And you know what? You know what was that that box set? The first 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
You're familiar with that, right?
Yeah.
It has a Listen with Nico on it,
right?
And I remember seeing that, and like seeing the single for Infinite Dreams in there. That might even be the last one that's covered in that box. And just looking at it like, what the hell is this? Like, I don't know this song. Like, I don't know this cover. So, yeah, just completely, completely weird to me.
Yeah, they had a string of platinum albums ever since Number of the Beast up through Somewhere in Time, even went double platinum. Mm-hmm. And then this album only went gold. It's not even platinum yet, far as I can tell. So, yeah. And what did Steve Harris say? He said... Well, Steve Harris said he thought it was their best album since Peace of Mind, which I already said. I think I agree with that. And then his quote is, he said he loved it because it was more progressive, which is funny because we've talked a lot on these episodes about Steve Harris and his love of progressive rock and how those elements make their way in. So, quote was, I was so pissed off with the Americans because they really didn't seem to accept it. So, yeah, yeah. Yeah, he was bummed out because he really loved it. And yeah, they did great work on this record. But I think it must have been the timing. You know, the cover, like you're talking about the Somewhere in Time cover. Well, look at the cover of this record. Rod Smallwood. Derek Riggs said that Rod Smallwood told him to make something surreal and bloody weird. So mission accomplished there.
Yeah, right.
It's like, what the hell is going on with that?
Totally. You know, I've owned all the albums, and usually when I would listen, and this is probably blasphemy, like I would listen at work at my old job, I would usually have a band on shuffle. So like I said, this was not an album I'd ever listen to front to back. It's tough to kind of rate it because it's so new to me. Peace of Mind has always been, you know, my favorite. It could be because this is fresh, but I think I enjoyed this more. Like there, as much as I love Peace of Mind, there are tracks on there I don't love,
mm-hmm.
but I didn't think that there was really a bum track on this. Like the more I listened to it and familiarized myself with it, like I really, really got into it, which was exactly what I was hoping for. So like this will totally be a go-to album for me.
That's awesome. That's great to hear because this is it's just, I mean, you never hear people talk about this or I don't know. I mean, I guess I don't really have a lot of conversations anymore with people about Iron Maiden, but this just really does not seem like a fan favorite to me. And I think it's great. It's it blows Somewhere in Time away for sure.
You know, I'll kind of get into this with the track by track, but do you think the keyboards have something to do with that? And what role do keyboards kind of play after this?
Yeah, they really get rid of the keyboards after this. And they started with the synthesized guitars on Somewhere in Time, but they were not as prominent. They were kind of prominent. I mean, you heard them right away, but with this, you know, right away when it opens up with that synth.
Oh yeah.
You know, it's they're very
that's
prominent.
Most blatant that it really gets in terms of like sequenced sounding keyboards, you know, whether they're sequenced or not, you know, just kind of like arpeggiated, you know, synth riffs.
Yeah, it's hard to go back to 1988 and think of what people's reaction would have been when they first put that on.
I'm not going back to 15.
No. I don't know how negative it was back then. I mean, I looked it up, and the week that this album came out, Dirty Dancing was in the middle of a 9-week run at number one on Billboard. So that was kind of... But then a few months later, Appetite for Destruction would be at number one. So, you know, 88 was weird.
Yeah, it was.
And where did Iron... No matter what record they put out, where did Iron Maiden fit in 88? I mean, who knows?
And I mean, you know, the most tragic thing about 1988 is you didn't have a Debbie Gibson album. You had one the year before in Out of the Blue, and the year after in Electric Youth. 88, nothing. You're welcome.
Well, that left an opening... For the Debbie Gibson fans that were looking for something to buy, they could have bought Seventh Son of a Seventh Son because they had that extra money on hand from their allowance or whatever.
If I'd only known.
Yeah, it probably did, especially in America.
Should I pick up Seventh Son of a Seventh Son or this shitty Kiss remix album with two horrible new songs?
Yeah, 88
was not a good time.
Yeah, I could remember 88 so clearly too.
When
Smash It, Thrashes and Hits was new, I can remember that very, very vividly. So
I remember exactly where it was in the store when I picked it up. I totally.
I remember
clear image.
Yeah, I think I was in eighth grade, and I remember the Circus magazine in the school library. The back cover was an ad for Smash It, Thrashes and Hits, and that's how I found out it was coming out. And I was like, holy shit.
I'm sorry, Circus magazine in the school library?
Yeah.
How the fuck does that happen? They have articles about groupies and shit.
Yeah, I would be in there on my study hall reading
the
Circus
back pages
magazine.
Has no business being in any school.
But that's funny that I have that memory of in the school library seeing the Smash It, Thrashes and Hits ad. I still know. I still remember that.
Like, for me, it was just stumbling upon it in the store. Like, usually, you know, I grabbed Circus and Hit Parader like crazy when I was a kid and don't remember ever reading anything about this coming out. And it was just like, it was just there one day. And I was like, what is this? And yeah, so like, I totally get that. Huge memory for me, too.
Yeah, that was probably right. I mean, it got to a point where I knew everything that was coming out before it came out. You know, I wasn't going to. No, I wasn't going to stumble upon anything because I was keeping tabs.
Right.
But I guess
right.
88, I wasn't quite there yet. I don't know.
No,
but, I
get it.
Yeah, I totally remember that. And so, you know, the question of why was this album so much less successful in America? Maybe it's the keyboards. Maybe it's just that Iron Maiden was passe. People had moved on to other stuff. You know, Guns N' Roses, so that's now everybody's like, well, this is what's cool. Iron Maiden's lame compared to Guns N' Roses. I guess And Justice for All was probably pretty, you know, people were moving on to Metallica and stuff like that. people who had liked Maiden before were moving on to different, especially in America, they were moving on to thrash metal and whatever.
Well, I mean, you know that... You know that song that the Guns N' Roses did with Iron Maiden, right?
No, what is it?
Sweet Moonchild of Mine?
I was hoping that you were going to do one of those on this episode, and that's a perfect segue.
I think that was the first time I ever went for it and totally blew it by laughing, because I was just bowled over by the ridiculousness of it. But yeah, if that's a good segue to get us in, then why not?
Yeah, that's a perfect segue to to move on to the track by track in the first song, which you just mentioned, Moonchild. Well, I guess, you know, we start out with the little folky J.R.R. Tolkien intro that Bruce wrote, which I really like that. You know, it's just short and sweet, and I don't have any problem with it at all. I think it's really cool.
No, I think that's a really cool way to kick off the song and the album.
But that's another thing to think about, though, is, you know, Iron Maiden fans, they put it on, first they get that, and then they get the keyboard kicks in, and they're like, what the fuck?
Yeah, like the only thing worse would have been fanfare from the other.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, I was thinking that it kind of is as close as Iron Maiden are going to get to fanfare is that little intro thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then the synth starts in, but...
Yeah. You know, well, it's funny, you know, I read the wiki page before I listened to the album, so when it said that it was kind of the first real use of keyboard on an Iron Maiden album, like, when that bit comes in the beginning, I was like, wow, this is going to be, like, a total synthed out album. And,
right.
You know, but that keyboard is really misleading. Like,
yeah,
the keyboard used throughout, I feel, is extremely tasteful and... to be honest, kind of necessary, because if there was anything that I would have... Look, great songs on the Iron Maiden albums between Number of the Beast and Power Slave. Incredible songs. But, you know, there are times where I've kind of felt that they could have used something else. I think the keyboard on this album is such a welcome thing for me to the Iron Maiden sound. I think it fits perfectly. And of course you can't go repeating that same trick over and over again, but I think it's completely tasteful in the rest of this album, and I love what it adds.
Yeah, I have no issue at all with the keyboards on here, and I really think the production is really good on this record. I don't have any problem at all with the production. So I think Moonchild is a great song. I think Bruce Dickinson is the MVP on this song. I think the lyrics are great. And I love his performance on this song. We've talked on earlier episodes about how Bruce Dickinson is really great in certain songs at playing a character and really getting into the role.
Yeah.
And I think his performance on this is one of his better, you know, role-playing performances where he's, you know, it's a hard thing to do and be taken seriously and pull it off, you know, and I think it's really well done. I got to think that his how much he gets into character is probably based on just his enthusiasm for the material, I think. And on some songs, you really feel him getting into the character more. And I think he really delivers on this song. So, and yeah, it's got great riffs and great melody. So, yeah, it's great. Great album opener.
Yeah, like there's a chord change before the chorus that I really, really dug. Enough to make a note of it. And also, like, the middle eight, just great. Like, some really cool tension and build there. And Iron Maiden always kind of has that thing when they're doing a bridge or a middle eight where you know they're leading up to the solo. So you, like, if you're a solo guy, and with Iron Maiden, it's hard not to be, you know, given the harmonies and all that stuff. Like, just such a great moment knowing that the solos come. Just a great, great opener. Love this song.
there's an Aleister Crowley novel called Moonchild, which the song I don't think has anything to do with it, other than I don't know if that's where he got the title even or not, but there's a lot of Iron Maiden songs where they take a title and then the song really has nothing to do with the source material. But
yeah, Moonchild by Aleister Crowley, read by Dr. Sinister. Chapter 1, The Chinese God. London in England, the capital city of the British Empire, is situated upon the banks of the Thames. It is not likely that these facts were unfamiliar to James Abbott McNeill Whistler, a Scottish gentleman born in America and resident in Paris, but it is certain that he did not appreciate them, for he settled quietly down to discover a fact which no one had previously observed, namely that it was very beautiful at night. The man was steeped in Highland fantasy, and he revealed London as wrapped in a soft haze of mystic beauty, a fairy tale of delicacy and wistfulness.
So the next song, Infinite Dreams, you kind of mentioned it, talking about the single. This is not only the keyboards at the beginning, but this must have been another shocking thing to hear for Maiden fans when this song begins, because to me it's bluesy almost.
Yeah. It was another one that, like, before it kind of kicked into the slower bit. It was just a different sound, and I don't really know that I could pinpoint, what it is, but it was definitely different.
Yeah, but one thing is they don't go back to it, so it's just the first verse, and then they don't revert back to that. The song just keeps moving on, and it turns into an intricately arranged, Iron Maiden opus.
Oh,
which
yeah,
is funny. It starts out as this. It doesn't even sound like an Iron Maiden song at first.
No.
But it really kicks in, and there's so many different parts to this song, and I think it's great.
Yeah.
I don't have a problem with how it starts, but it must have been weird for Iron Maiden fans to hear it at first, back in 1988. It turns into a classic Maiden-sounding song by the end.
Yeah,
so
I agree. And I love the sound of, that intro. I'm always a sucker for, a cleanly picked... arpeggio guitar with a distorted guitar playing a lead kind of on top of that. And that happens throughout on a couple of the intros on this album. But when it kicks into that slower tempo and the keyboards come in, it's so great. There's a way that the chords lift there during that section that is awesome. You get the usual harmonized riffs halfway before the tempo picks up again. Just such a great sound. Then another slow bit coming back in. Huge highlight of the album for me, and unassuming from, the beginning of the song. Totally not where I thought it was going. Didn't think I would come away with this being, a favorite. But like you said, it keeps moving and it's great.
Yeah, and it's got great melodies, both the vocal melody and the guitar melodies. So
totally.
It's very melodic, and it starts off ballady, but it's definitely not a ballad by the end.
No, not at all.
Yeah, and I was thinking in terms of the story of the concept album.
Uh-oh.
I guess the first song we get the devil talking, and now this song, is this the person that the devil's talking about tormenting with these dreams they're having? I don't know.
Right.
That's about as far as it goes, as far as story. I don't know where the hell else the story is going.
Yeah.
But I was thinking, one thing I was thinking is, if... just as far as sequencing an album, it might have made more sense to flip this song with the next song. It's kind of a weird second song, and to get like the poppy single as the second song might have just, it doesn't really matter, but it just might have made more sense. I don't know.
Yeah, theoretically, maybe.
Yeah. But yeah, it doesn't matter.
And, but like, you have the same kind of thing with Revelations. Is that that's second on Peace of Mind.
Right.
The same kind of deal. In fact, this reminded me of it at times. Like
I wrote that down, yeah.
Yeah, when it goes into that slow section, like I immediately thought Revelations. And, same kind of thing where like, that's a bit of an epic and coming in, second track on with the poppy track, Flight of Icarus, following it, right?
Exactly. Yeah, so, right. Very similar.
Same kind of trajectory going on with this one.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, that's exactly right. And I did, there's especially one part of the song that makes you think of Revelations, for sure.
Yeah, I totally wrote that down and I skipped it. But yeah, if we're both thinking it, then it's there.
Yeah, it's there. Yeah, so yeah, Flight of Icarus, next song is a very similar kind of vibe to that, even poppier. I guess it started out as an Adrian Smith ballad that was called On the Wings of Eagles.
Yes.
Which sounds like it was from Top Gun soundtrack or something.
Oh, good God. Imagine that.
But then Bruce wrote some lyrics for it, and he changed the title, and then it's funny, I was reading, I think it was in the book, the Mick Wall book, where it said that Steve wrote the weird middle part, and after he says, said the prophet, after Bruce does that laugh, mm-hmm. and then it goes into some weird riffs and stuff,
mm-hmm.
and it said Adrian hated it.
Oh, really?
Steve Harris stuck that part in the song.
Oh, man.
And, of course, we know that Adrian left after this album.
Yeah.
And here we have a song that he had written that Bruce and Steve took and turned into something completely different, and apparently he wasn't that pleased with how it turned out. So
yeah.
I don't know if that's part of I think really the Adrian Smith story is he wanted to go out, he was a songwriter himself, and he wanted to go out and do, be the main man in his own thing,
and he's taking lead vocals on B-sides, and
yeah,
you kind of see that coming.
Is this Iron Maiden's poppiest single, do you think?
I had to think so.
Yeah,
like it's so, I don't even know if it's major key, but it sounds so major key.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would say, I don't know, Wasted Years is up there too.
Yeah.
Like I feel like that's, like in terms of like an Iron Maiden earworm, that's really the one that always gets me. Like that chorus is just so dripping with awesome pop goodness.
Yeah, I like Wasted Years more than I Play With Madness. But
yeah, I do too. Like I think that right off the bat, it kind of didn't have anything for me. Like, I love the chorus, though. Like, I think it's a great, great chorus. But, and I think that's really what makes it feel like singles material for me. Like, the chorus is so great on it. But, like, the rest of the song, like, I would totally take, Wasted Years, Flight of Icarus, something like that, over this. But it's, by the time it started, and I thought that, this is kind of maybe a little too up. I don't know. I don't know exactly what the term is I'm going for. Still liked it. And of course, I knew this one from, you know, it was either one of the live albums or that Visions of the Beast DVD with all the videos on it. So I was familiar with it. But yeah, good song. But, you know, in terms of great pop standards, I would give it to Wasted Years.
Yeah, I agree. It's definitely a really good song. Definitely the most simplistic, straightforward thing on the album.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely.
And, well, I mean, I wrote down, if Iron Maiden could get on the radio with Wasted Years in this, then, you know, how were they going to get on this? Is, you know, this was their best shot at having a hit single in any year, I think. So, yeah. And it was a big hit everywhere else but the U.S.
Yeah.
As far as where it fits into the concept...
Oh, boy.
This is where it reminds me of The Elder, because I get the feeling you've got this kid, this seventh son, wandering through the forest with weird people talking to him. That's what I get from The Elder, too. It's like all of a sudden, whoever's talking and only you is like talking to the kid. And it's like, can I play with his madness? Who is talking and who are they talking to? And what does it have to do with the story? I don't know.
You're right.
But yeah, it's a really good song. I like it a lot. So
Yeah, it's good. It's good.
It doesn't have much of a bridge. It's not arranged, you know, it's just really simple for an Iron Maiden song, I guess.
I think maybe that's another thing that just makes it poppy. It doesn't really move into anything unexpected, like most Iron Maiden stuff would, you know.
Right.
Thank you.
Evil That Men Do, the next song, this is one of my personal favorite Iron Maiden songs, like top five in the Iron Maiden catalog to me, because this song is all melody. There's four great melodies in the song, which I love. I love it. So there's so many hooks.
Yeah, I'll get to it after you're done, but I just noticed a misspelling in my notes where it says, this is a really Hugs highlight, in my opinion. That's supposed to be huge, but apparently I was thinking about Hugs and just how much I completely love this song. Yeah, you're completely dead on this one.
Yeah, well, maybe I should let you go so I don't hog all the comments.
I can do that. Of course, you have the classic Iron Maiden gallop appearing on the album. I love the way that they change up things for the pre-chorus, which ends up being the pre-pre-chorus.
Exactly. Yeah.
the pre-chorus is so good. The living on the razor's edge bit. God damn. Oh. The chorus is so soaring. It gets a little close to Trooper territory before the solo, but that doesn't bother me at all. And I love how it goes back into the pre-chorus again. There's a little trick in there where the harmonizing guitar riffs get a little less close. The harmonies kind of go farther apart, and then they come back in again. Really, really great. As I said, huge highlight. Definitely a standout on this record.
It's got four melodies, and all four of them are great. So what more can you ask for? You know, the first line, love is a razor, and I walk the line on that silver blade or whatever, and that melody's great. And then the I will pray for her part, that's the next part. Yeah. That's great. And then you said the limit out of razors, that would be a great chorus. They could be done there. But then they go into a killer chorus after that.
Yeah, it's like three moments that build up to the chorus, and it's masterfully done. Like you would want to just write one of those hooks, right?
Exactly.
Like to just like lay them on top of you and just propel the way that this song does. Like that is a masterstroke right there.
Yeah, it's really great. And also you get a great guitar break too. So like I said, top five of all of the Iron Maiden catalog for me.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I would probably agree. It would be up there.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So that's the first side. And then we
rub it in.
Flip the record over, and we get the title track, which is the Steve Harris Prague epic. Mm-hmm. Kind of oddly placed at the beginning of side two. Of course, now in 2016, what the hell does that mean anymore? But back then it meant something. And, you know, this, it's funny. I was thinking this song tells the story that the whole album was supposed to tell.
Right. You get it all in a 9.5 minute track.
Yeah. I would say I like the first half of the song, but it gets real boring in the middle.
You think so?
Yeah. Yeah, there's a real slow part there for a couple minutes. There's great guitars at the end.
Okay. Are you talking about, like, when the hi-hat just kind of takes it, when it really slows down, you get, like, the high bass notes playing? And
yeah, I think it just goes on too long. It does. It sure as hell doesn't need to be 10 minutes because, you know, a normal Iron Maiden epic, you get this crazy arrangement with a lot of different guitar breaks and stuff, and you don't get that as much in this song until the last, like, 2 minutes.
Yeah.
But you get, like, this 2 or 3 minute interlude where there's not a lot happening. Mm-hmm. Not even.
See, I didn't mind it. It kind of worked for me.
I think it's definitely the kind of thing where if you're listening to the whole album in the dark with the headphones and you're just into it, mm-hmm. then you would love it. But
yeah.
If you put it on in the car, you're probably going to hit the skip button at some point. Okay. At least me.
That makes sense.
I don't know.
That makes sense. Like, I was really, the times that I listened to it, I was really concentrating on it. So it worked for me. And I'm a more patient man than you are, BJ.
This is not a bad song, that's for
sure. No.
But I think it's weird it wasn't the last song in the album. That's what kind of is weird.
Well, yeah, my notes for Only the Good Die Young kind of mention that it is odd that they don't go out on an epic, and I think that this would, work, yeah. I think that it would have worked at the end. I think you need that epic at the end of an Iron Maiden album.
And even though it's a concept album, it wouldn't have messed up the story.
Yeah, right. It doesn't matter.
It would have made more sense because it's like summing everything up.
Yeah. But like you also have on this kind of like the like operatic voices kind of at the end and like synth voice. I assume it's synth voice kind of going, you know, choir-y kind of vocal stuff in the second half. But I also love, like, when that distorted riff comes in, like, you have the hi-hat bit, and then all of a sudden the bass drum comes back in, and the distorted guitar riffs are, like, jumping from left to right. Love that. And it's just a great sound. Yeah. I think this was my favorite song of the record. You would not be in that camp?
Really? This is your favorite song?
It was really tough. It was between this and The Evil That Men Do.
Yeah. Yeah, Evil That Men Do is definitely my favorite.
Yeah, that might take it. I love them both. I think maybe I'm not burned out on the middle section yet, so it still has that shine for me.
Well, that would just be the one criticism I could come up with, I guess.
Yeah,
of the whole album, probably. That would be it.
Yeah,
but even though the next song is probably my least favorite on the album, it's, you know, the competition is tough here.
Because
this is a great album. So,
yeah.
But yeah, The Prophecy, very classic sounding Iron Maiden song though. That's when this is as far as like the what you think of as the Iron Maiden sound, this album sounds way more like Iron Maiden than Somewhere in Time does. In
my opinion. Makes sense.
I don't think a lot of people realize that, or I get the impression of that. This is not an out there departure for Iron Maiden.
No, not at all. Like, there wasn't really anything or even really any song, with the exception of maybe like the kind of beginning of Infinite Dreams, where I was like, yeah, they're really throwing you a left turn here. Like you totally have and it comes up again here, that the gallopy Iron Maiden verse, you know. Yeah, like throughout there wasn't anything that really I thought was like way out there.
Right, and I guess one of the benefits of this not being a real full-fledged concept album like Steve Harris wanted is a lot of times you get where the lyrics are, they start trying to shoehorn in the story,
mm-hmm.
and the song, and then that doesn't service the song.
Yeah.
So you don't get that on this record. You don't get, this song might be this song is kind of weird, but it doesn't feel like a song where they're just trying to fit in information.
Agreed.
But yeah, so this song is kind of weird, especially the chorus.
Mm-hmm.
It's a cool song, and you know, but yeah. Is it your least favorite on the record, or?
It was the least favorite, but it's got like bits that I love. Like,
yeah.
But like the thing for me really is I love the acoustic bit that this song ends on. Like for me, that could have been extracted and extended and made its own track. Like I love the acoustic bit. It's so. I don't know. I feel like it's atypical of what they do, but I think it's great.
Any little guitar melodies that Iron Maiden does, they're always great, pretty much.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, so the next song, this was another hit single, top 10 single in the UK, and I remember this video. This was they played it on Headbangers Ball a lot, and I loved this song. This was the first song that Steve Harris wrote for the record. I thought it was a funny story. He said there was this famous psychic in the UK, Doris Stokes. It was like a medium. I don't know if she did the talking to the dead thing, like the John Edward type bullshit, probably. But Steve Harris, when she died, Steve Harris had this thought, you know, I wonder if she foresaw her own death. And so that's what he based the idea for this song on.
The car smashing through the plate glass windows was the last straw for Anita Sibley. Since she took over the estate agency 2 years ago, pictures have disappeared from walls, files and papers have been strewn all over the place, office machinery has failed to work, a gas bottle has exploded, and a brick mysteriously appeared one morning on the floor. Anita feels a presence around her. So does Manfred, her dog, especially near a back office where the previous owner worked. A Bible, opened at random every day, has still not kept the ghost away. So Anita asked Doris Stokes, the celebrated medium and clairaudient, a hearer of voices, to come and help. And Doris, listening and talking to the ghostly presence all the time, passed on what he said to Anita and me.
And I'd pick up the man in question that's causing the bother, took himself over. In your language, means committed suicide.
That's right.
Are we right about that?
Yes.
What did you do it for, son? Oh, I don't know, he said. Things seem to be going wrong. And yet I shouldn't have blamed my wife. He was a bit rotten to her, he said. He's very angry. But the main cause of his anxiety is he wants to ask his wife to forgive him because he left her in a bit of a mess. Yes, we'll do that for him. Is that all you wanted, love? Is that all you wanted, to get Anita to tell your wife that you're sorry?
But it appeared his wife was in Australia at the moment.
She's coming back in April 12th. That was just then. When she comes back, will you buy her some flowers and say, your husband's asked me to get you these, and say, will you forgive him for what he did? Because they haven't been married very long, love.
Anita, you now have heard from Doris what it is you're supposed to do, which is really to talk to the man's wife. You know his name, don't you, in fact?
I do, yes.
To talk to his wife, whom you also know.
Yes.
And to buy her flowers on April the 12th. Those are the main things you have to do, isn't it?
Yes.
Do you now feel that as a result of what Doris has told you, that this entity will now leave this building?
I'll buy the flowers, I'll speak to the man's wife, and I'll tell you afterwards, but I sincerely hope it will.
Thank you.
What's really weird about this song is the chorus is my least favorite part of the song.
Yeah, I agreed there.
Yeah. So the guitar melodies are so great, and the verse is awesome. So yeah, it's a great song, but there aren't a lot of songs where the chorus is the worst part.
Yeah. Yeah, it is a really solid song. This was kind of most of the first listenings to it. It kind of just went by until I really concentrated on it, and then I really got into it. But this was kind of the sleeper on the first few listens. But yeah, totally with you on the I do love the the bass intro, of course. Drums are great on this. Some great tempo shifts in there. Just one that I kind of had to pay attention to really get it. Yeah, it's a solid song.
Yeah, I like it a lot. And this is one of those songs I've talked about. There's Iron Maiden songs where a guitar riff or a harmony guitar bit or something is like a hook, like a melodic hook in the song, where it serves as a bridge or a chorus even. And this song has that, where just the guitar part, the riffs and stuff are so melodic that this would be great as an instrumental, you know?
Yeah, I agree. So. And there are some great parts where the guitar really complements the vocal. Which is, just another kind of earworm that I always love.
It's almost like this song could have been as good as Evil That Men Do with a better chorus. The lyrics are kind of dumb on the chorus. And and it's kind of an awkward transition to the chorus, too, I think. It doesn't flow quite. I used the word shoehorned earlier. It's like the chorus is a little bit shoehorned in there. And there's a time to live, there's a time to die. I mean,
Oh, right.
Those should be placeholder lyrics, but they shouldn't end up on the final, in the final product.
Wow. Yeah, I think I agree with that.
But I guess there's a little play on words. I mean, as soon as you're born, you're dying. I guess that's kind of clever. But the time to live, time to die, that's a little bit overused. You might want to at least tweak it a little bit. Yes, yeah, so then we get to the last song. I really think what I would do is flip it, make Clairvoyant, Only the Good Die Young, the first two songs, and then do like the Prophecy, Seventh Son. I think that would make a lot more sense.
Yeah, I think I'd agree.
But yeah, the Only the Good Die Young, similar. I feel like this song is like a sister song to Evil That Men Do in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think of it?
Yeah, I think I would agree. It's... like I said, my one complaint is that it's not the epic, but I don't think that this song really could serve as that. The thing that I loved about this song, another just great chorus, and I love how you have like the four line chorus, and then it goes into a section where I don't know if it's a key change or everything, but the whole melody lifts, and then the answer lines disappear, and they're replaced by riffs, and the keyboards under it just so great. It's up there with one of my favorite choruses on the album and really made the song for me. And Harris has a great kind of sneaky lead bass bit, that happens in there. And I love it. I think this is a great track.
Yeah, it's great. Great guitar that opens the song.
Yeah.
It's got like the growling verse like Evil That Men Do had, and then a great bridge, the Time It Waits for No Man bridge. And then, really good chorus. Yeah, it's similar in construction to Evil That Men Do. Not quite as good, but... Yeah, I like it a lot.
Hard to touch that one.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, but it is kind of weird as the last song on the record.
Yeah, totally agree. Like, I don't understand that sequencing at all.
No.
Like, I don't know. That just makes no sense to me.
No, it really doesn't. It just, I mean, maybe they thought it's just way too obvious to put Seventh Son at the end, but it is obvious, so it's kind of weird.
Yeah.
And this at the end is just... I don't know.
Yeah, that's what makes less sense than just not closing with an epic. Like it's
right.
It's just not an album closer, really,
No.
But still great.
Yeah. Even the Clairvoyant would have made more sense as the last song than this, I think.
Yeah, I think I agree.
Walking on water, a miracle door you can trust. Magic sins, seven ways to win, seven holy paths to hell. Seven downward slopes, seven bloodied hopes, seven are your burning fires, seven your desires.
So you're saying this is your favorite Iron Maiden album now? Is that what you're saying?
It's tough to say. Like, you know, I haven't sat with it for an incredibly long time, but there's nothing on here that I think is really lacking. Like, every song is really strong. And, like, you know, even with you know, Peace of Mind, which I said was my favorite, like, I would swap out a song, you know?
Yeah, there's no Quest for Fire on this album.
Yeah, no, there is not. So, it's really solid.
Song for song, it can't get much stronger than a record like this. It's just... so good all the way through.
Yeah. That, and I mean, this is really fresh to me right now. It could be that as well. Who knows? But I have a feeling that this will be a go-to for a while. I liked it that much. Like, I didn't expect to love anything as much. You know, I thought it would be a solid record, but I didn't think that I would love anything on here as much as I love, like, The Evil That Men Do and the title track. Just so good, you know? I wanted to appreciate it and thought I would, but like it exceeded expectations, and that made me incredibly happy. So, yeah, I think I'm kind of comfortable saying that it could be the favorite. And just based on the fact that, like, yes, it is new and fresh, but like all these songs are great. And as you said, there's really no filler on this thing.
Yeah, right. So then what happens to the band after this is really confusing. I mean... From an American point of view, it made sense, but knowing that this was so successful everywhere else,
mm-hmm.
Were they so consumed with being successful in America? Now, knowing how much issues they had with Bruce during Somewhere in Time and everything, because I mean, you know, we're going to get to it on the next episode, but the next two albums for me just feel like they're going through the motions. And so it's
so what's that? No Prayer for the Dying and
Fear of the Dark.
Yeah. Dark, okay.
It's just this record is so inspired and so great and so well done. It's just sad. It's just hard to understand where they went after this.
I agree. Now let me ask you a question, since you're familiar with those albums and I am not. One of the things that I read, and I want to attribute it to the Iron Maiden commentary site, although it may not have been there. There was a comment about this album being the last to feature Bruce in excellent voice.
Right.
I don't know that I ever really heard a drop. I didn't kind of jump album to album, but more kind of grabbed the discography to listen to as a whole. Is that something that is like obvious? Like, I always thought he had an incredible voice.
No, I remember. Well, what was the first single on No Prayer for the Dying? Was that Be Quick or Be Dead, or was that Fear of the Dark? The first single on No Prayer for the Dying was Holy Smoke. I totally remember when that came out thinking Bruce changed the way he sings. I remember the first time I heard it. Yeah, he's got more of like a raspy growl, which when you go back and listen, he does do it on earlier stuff.
Yeah.
But not for the whole song. And not that pronounced the way he does it on Holy Smoke.
Okay.
And that was the first single from No Prayer for the Dying. So his voice really did change. It just become like raspier with more and more gruff or something.
And that's the whole album? That's not just that track?
It's not the whole album, but it's definitely noticeable. Yeah, it's definitely noticeable. He uses it a lot more. And I totally remember when it was new thinking that.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Well, and of course, Adrian Smith had left. I mean, in between this album and No Prayer for the Dying, Adrian Smith leaves the band, and then Bruce makes a really mediocre solo album, which I wrote down, I can't imagine Steve Harris was too chuffed about it. Is that proper use of the word?
Yes, it was. Which one was that? Was
that Tattooed Millionaire.
That wasn't Balls to Picasso?
No, Tattooed Millionaire, there's almost no Iron Maiden in it, and it's not good. It really feels like, in retrospect, that Bruce Dickinson just stayed around for the paycheck for those two records.
No, wait. Are any of... I have not heard any of them. Are any of his solo albums good?
There's some good songs.
Yeah.
I haven't listened to it much, though.
Okay.
But he did go a lot heavier, do a lot more heavier music. Tattooed Millionaire is not heavy at all.
Okay.
And, you know, it came out in 1990, and it's almost like he was trying to fit in with what was popular in hard rock in 1990.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it definitely wasn't a hit or anything. But, you right. know, then he did.
Well, I mean, he was obviously competing with, you know, like Cadillac Dreams.
Yeah, most of it's about on that quality level, too.
Wow.
But, yeah, he, you know, he did Bring Your Daughter to the Slaughter. He did it for a movie soundtrack as a solo song.
Oh, really?
First. Okay. Yeah, and then Maiden recorded it and became their first number one single. But it was just kind of a dumb Bruce solo song.
That was a number one single? Really?
In the UK, yeah, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, it's crazy. So they were still having success, but they definitely, yeah, the drop in quality from Seventh Son to No Prayer for the Dying is so drastic.
Really?
That yeah, it's...
Maybe this is the spot to jump off.
All right, well, thank you so much.
You're
Craig,
welcome.
For talking Thanks. Seventh Son with me, and I'm so glad that that... I mean, this was kind of your, this, you know, you started listening to this record just for this show, and now you, it's a record you're going to be listening to a lot, it sounds like, so that's
Yeah,
awesome.
Totally. This was a home run. Thank yeah, you.
That's great. Hopefully, there's a lot of people listening maybe that hadn't really given this record a chance, and now they're going to realize how great it is because it's killer, so.
Yeah, I mean, if you like anything about Iron Maiden, I can't see not loving this. Like, it really... I feel like arrangement-wise, there are parts that kind of go deeper and are more rewarding than kind of some of the epic tracks on other albums. I can't really find fault with it. There's, you know, a dodgy chorus here or there. Nothing to trash a song on, you know. More just get through this section and the next section's awesome. So, yeah, I would totally recommend this. And, like, you know, I'm no Iron Maiden aficionado, but... as a, you know, moderate fan, definitely would say that it's worth listening to.
Yeah, and I don't know if it gets tagged as, like, the keyboard album, if that's part of what people know about it, but there's a lot of great Iron Maiden guitar on this record.
Before kind of listening to this, I would have thought that Somewhere in Time was the keyboard album.
Yeah.
Just thematically and by looking at it. You know, like it's just got that look to it, you know, judging a book by the cover. Like, and again, to say that this is a keyboard album is pretty unfair. Like the keyboards are washes, you know, aside from that arpeggio and in the very beginning of the first track, they're really just kind of like giving a washy background under guitars. You know, it's really supplemental and really good.
Yeah. The way they say it is on Somewhere in Time they used guitar synthesizers, and this is the album where they actually switched to keyboards.
Yeah.
But I read some quote where they were talking about how they ended up getting a keyboard player because Bruce and Steve and Adrian were trying to play the stuff themselves, and they were playing it all with one finger. And mm-hmm. that made me think of when you said one finger programming when you were praising Kanye West the No Shame.
Well, you know what? It's funny you should say that because, like, I'm a keyboard player, and in the band I used to be in, our vocalist, he was the chief songwriter, would put stuff together, and then, you know, he'd be writing, and then I'd be called in to do some stuff, and he would do one finger keyboard stuff that it wasn't technically proficient by any means, but it served the song better than I could with a knowledge of how to play a keyboard. Like, it was just the right simplistic thing where I would have done something more heavy-handed or more, you know, technically advanced. And, you know, you hear that on here, like the vocalist in my band would go for a note. If he was playing one note, it would be a note, the one note I wouldn't go for. And I felt that listening to this, like, it was... the keyboard stuff is simplistic, and a lot of it is one note stuff. A lot of it isn't even, like, you know, full out chords. They're kind of just like one synth note, but really the right thing at the right time. And that's what I could be completely talking out of my ass with this, because I don't know the arrangements that well, but that's how it felt to me. It was, they were clean and they were simple and not really weighed down and really added a lot.
Yeah, I think that's all they do is add to it. And they're definitely not obtrusive or
no.
None of the songs are, they're not the main instrument in any part except that very beginning. So they're used to kind of enhance it, I guess.
Sure. If you take anything away from this, it's just that, you know, the things that I read about this being the keyboard album, that's really unfair to call it that. Like, it really is background and it really is supplemental. And I think it works great.
Yeah, I agree.
It fits in well. Like, I think it works well with them. And I, to tell you the truth, I would have loved to hear, you know, some of the stuff that I really love on previous albums to have some of that kind of some of that backing it. Like, I think that could have helped songs in previous albums. Like I said, probably something I shouldn't say since those albums are held in really high esteem. But I think that it's a great mix for them.
And another thing is that there's nothing about this album that sounds dated either, which is another thing that hard rock falls into with keyboards is it sounds dated or something like that, but that's not an issue here either.
Yeah. So yeah, no, not at all.
It totally holds up, so.
Completely.
All right, well, thanks a lot. And
thank you.
I said, I'm really glad that you liked it as much as you do. That's awesome. So.
Yeah, I'm very happy that you asked me to do this, and it was a fun time, and I'm glad that I have another album to add to the rotation.
And now, to play us out.
What does that mean, to play us out? I don't know what that means, to play us out. What does that mean? To end the show?
Yeah.
I'm going to leave you with a song by ASAP, which stands for Adrian Smith and Project. Adrian Smith left Iron Maiden after Seventh Son of a Seventh Son, and the next year, in 1989, he put out a record with his new group, ASAP. The album was called Silver and Gold. And there's a song on that album called Fallen Heroes. And this is my theory. I think that this is the song that was turned into Can I Play With Madness. I think there was an Adrian Smith song called On the Wings of Eagles that Bruce and Steve took and ran with it and turned it into Can I Play With Madness. I think that original On the Wings of Eagles song was then turned into this song on the ASAP album. So it's a song called Fallen Heroes by ASAP. Let me know if you think I'm right, but I think that this also comes from the same source material as Can I Play With Madness. It was just, once again, the same way Can I Play With Madness was a rewrite of that song. I think this is a rewrite of that song in a different direction. Let me know what you think. So here it is, Fallen Heroes by ASAP. Till next time.
I'll be back.